Whether we're interested in fashion or not, society dictates that we should wear clothes. Clothes are made by someone. They are made of fabric. And what happens to our old clothes? Today, I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a woman who has found and written a masterful book answering all these questions and more. She's Dana Thomas, and she's the author of Gods and Kings and the New York Times bestseller Deluxe. She's written for virtually all the glosses and highbrow newspapers. Dana lives in Paris and has written her latest book, Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Hello, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Dana, can you hit us? Oh, no. First of all, Fashionopolis. Tell us about the name. Obviously, it's Greek, you know.
It is Greek, and it goes back to two different things. Cottonopolis, which was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in Manchester 250 years ago, when Richard Arkwright created the water frame and kicked off the Industrial Revolution in mass manufacturing and factories. Manchester was known as Cottonopolis. And the industry that we have today, the supply chain we have today, the way our clothes are made, still go back to how it was originally created in Cottonopolis 250 years ago, where the cotton came in from one place, the south of the United States and from India, arrived in Liverpool, was ferried to Manchester, and then turned into fabric and then shipped back out again around the world. We think that globalization is only 30 years old or so, but in fact, it's been going on for 250 years. And Cottonopolis also refers to Fritz Lang's movie from the 1920s, a silent picture about how the workers toil underground for the rich who live in shiny towers above ground. And this was before we had skyscrapers. He imagined skyscrapers before skyscrapers existed. And about the break in this income inequality, this division of wealth, and how, you know, the masses work for the few rich. And that also goes back to Frederick Engels, who wrote Condition of the Working Class about 150 years ago, where he detailed the nightmares, the horrors of Cottonopolis. Then I found myself reading Aristotle, as one does, Aristotle's Politics. And he talked about Plato, which then took me back to Plato, which I hadn't read in a long time. And I saw how Plato talked about the polis, about how we need to create a just society. And if we do, then everything will work better. And I thought, well, today the fashion industry is a reflection of a very unjust society, that we live in this fashionopolis. Everything we touch has something to do with fashion. We don't realize it, but it does. 1/6 of the population works in the industry somehow. I think about 1/3 of our planet is dedicated to agriculture. Much of that is for growing flax, cotton, sheep for wool, goats for cashmere. And, you know, today the carbon industry, the clothing industry, is responsible for 10% of our global carbon emissions and 20% of our water, industrial water pollution. So, you know, it really does touch us in all these different ways. And it is unjust, but I think we should aim towards Plato's ideal of having a just society.
And being more conscious of what we're doing.
And being more conscious of what we're doing. Plato talked about how we need to have courage and wisdom. And right now I think we're missing some of that, at least in the fashion industry, to do things the proper way, to do them right.
Well, I think you think about food industry, everything's still plastic packed. And I mean, everything, you know, the way Amazon's run, the way everything's done is now. We're all questioning it at last.
You know? At last, yes, finally. Yeah. Yeah. And it is true. I mean, there were several books that inspired this one. One was Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser, where he examined the fast food industry and its impact on society and the planet. And The Omnivore's Dilemma, which looked at industrial farming in the same way. And those books really had an impact on me and how I changed my eating habits. And, you know, I've always had an organic garden, but really did start looking more towards how our food is produced and patronizing, you know, farmers markets even more than I had before. And I wanted to do the same with fashion, because most of us do not know how our clothes are made or where they're made. Even brands don't even know how or where they're made. And if the brands don't know, how can we know? And we should know. So we need to demand transparency from the brands, and we need to cherish what we have and buy smartly, buy well. If there's a hashtag that could come out of this book, it would be buy less, buy better.
Fabulous. Love it. So how does fashion rule the planet? I mean, you said it sort of in sort of sweeping terms, but how does it?
Well, you know, like I said, one out of six people work in the fashion industry. You know, at any given moment of the day, half the planet is wearing blue jeans. And blue jeans, we produce 6 billion pairs of blue jeans every year. I mean, that's a staggering number. If we were to stop, we produced 100 billion garments a year, and only 80 billion are sold. 20% of all garments produced are just chucked in the bin, destroyed without even being sold. This is the impact of the economies of scale. I'm not sure how you can say you save money by overproducing and throwing stuff away, but that is the business model that's been in place for 250 years. What I write about in the book is a whole group of, you know, young entrepreneurs who are trying to change that through things like direct consumer and made to order and zero waste business models. And they're showing that if you have zero waste, it's actually a better way of doing business. If you have a conscious fashion design and company, you're saving money and you're saving time and you're saving the planet from unneeded waste.
But couldn't we say that's just, again, for the rich and the middle class that can afford that? I mean, you know, Primark's probably a godsend to, you know, the poor single mother down the road.
Well, yes and no. I mean, 20 years ago when Fast Food Nation came out, who would have imagined there would be salad at McDonald's? But today we have salad at McDonald's. You know, there weren't very many farmers markets. Now we have Whole Foods. The beauty of this, it's a bit like the cell phone. I remember when cell phones first came out, they were so expensive, only a hand, you know, only the rich could afford them. They cost an arm and a leg. And now everybody has a cell phone. That the more that we move into this area and we adopt these practices, the more affordable it will all become, because it will become the norm. And today, fashion is the lowest, is the cheapest it's ever been. It's never cost so little in relation to everything else that we do and have. We generally today pay the same prices for fashion that we did in the 1930s during the height of the Depression. The same price, even though we're making more money and everything else has gone up in price. I mean, I want to do a chart. I haven't had a moment yet to sort of track the price of eggs and the price of gasoline and the price of houses and our income, how much our income has gone up in the last 100 years, and then mark that next to the price of clothes. So we've been conditioned to think that it's normal to pay 10 euros pounds for a shirt or a dress, when it is absolutely not. The only reason that those clothes cost so less is because everyone who has been involved in their making has been squeezed at poverty levels to do this work for no money, whether it's the farmers or it's the mill workers or it's the people who sew. Even the people who sell them are really poorly paid. And if we were to pay what they were worth, we would buy less. We buy 5 times more clothes today than we did a generation ago. And we wear them an average of 7 times before throwing them away. We aren't investing in our clothes, and therefore we're not treating them as if that we had invested in them. We should be buying less and buying better. And we should not think that we need to go out and buy something new every time something comes up. We can shop our closet. We can shop our friends' closets. We can repair. We can rent. We can resell. We can buy on resale. So while it seems like, you know, an organic cotton shirt may be out of our price range, it in fact isn't if you take all these other aspects into account. I recently went to a lovely sustainable pop-up in Kensington at Christmas time, and I bought a beautiful tuxedo shirt, 100% organic cotton with buttons made out of,
Well, it wouldn't be ivory.
Palm. Buttons lovely. Made out of palm. Lovely. And the shirt cost me £120. And you say, well, that's a lot of money. But it's so beautiful, I don't need to buy another good white shirt for until it wears out, which will probably be a good 20 years. And then once it does, I can put it in the compost and use it to feed my English roses. So, you know, instead of buying a bad shirt that'll crack after 5 or 10 washings and then throwing it away and it goes into landfill and it poisons the earth, I've bought something that'll last. And so maybe I spent 10 times more, it'll last 20 times longer. we need to think about our clothes that way, buying well.
Yes, because I made a decision sort of at the beginning, you know, New Year's resolution, but I wasn't going to buy any clothes this year apart from underwear. And I was wondering whether you think, Dana, that's a bit extreme, because now I'm starting to look in the shops and thinking, oh, I'm beginning to really want to buy something.
No, I don't think that's extreme at all. If we stopped making clothes today, we'd still have enough clothes to dress the planet for the next 50 years. We have such an oversupply of clothes that are underpriced. And, you know, if you stop to think about it, if it costs more to dry clean the garment than it did to pay for the garment, there's something wrong with the pricing system. And because of that, say you spill something on the shirt that cost you $9.99 and it costs $19.99 to dry clean it, you're going to toss it in the bin. And that's a wasteful, I mean, we don't stop to think about all that went into the creation of that before we tossed it. It's interesting. I met somebody recently who said, well, if you spill red wine on your shirt, it's not ruined. You should dunk the whole shirt in red wine and turn it into a burgundy shirt. And I thought, yes, of course. Or if you spill tea on something, then tea dye it and it becomes a different, then you have a new shirt or a new dress. And I thought, right, that's a great solution to, instead of just throwing things away. We should never throw our clothes in the bin. We should always have some solution for them somehow. And if we can, recycle them in one way or another.
I do find young people, though, don't have the skills to mend things. Like, I, you know, the other day my husband said, put the button on, oh, could you quickly put my button on my shirt? Or can you sew this hem? Or I'm sewing a hem, or I'm doing something. And I don't think twice about it. And then I said to my daughter, would you like to learn to sew? She said, Mummy, I'd love to.
Yes. You know. Sadly, at the same time that we had this last 30 years of unbridled globalization and all the manufacturing moving offshore, we had schools cutting things like sewing classes because they said they didn't have the budget to pay for them anymore. So we lost the knowledge of people who worked in the industry, because we knew people in the industry when it was a domestic industry. And, you know, I think about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the wonderful television program. And, you know, the father-in-law of Mrs. Maisel owns a dress company in the garment district of New York City. We knew those people, or we were related to them, or you saw them walking down the street. And we don't have that anymore. And then we also don't know how to sew a hem or repair or put a button back on. We don't have the craft of needlework in our fingers anymore because our grandmothers didn't do it and our mothers didn't do it. And we don't have it at schools and there's no one to teach us. Happily, there is a rise in the crafting, I guess in crafting, you would say, in making things again. And so there are sewing classes and knitting circles and popping up left and right. I recently met a woman in church who was doing needlepoint in church because she said she listens more carefully when she's doing her needlework.
That's lovely.
And we've decided to get together, and I still do needlework because it's something I've done since I was a little kid, and I find it very relaxing. And so we've decided that, you know, once a month we're going to get together and have a glass of wine and do needlework together and gab. And I, you know, there is a return to sewing circles and young people who want to learn this, and there are classes, which is great. And can you find them in community places like churches and libraries even, and, you know, wherever there's community outreach, you'll find there are classes. My daughter in Paris, we were walking down a street one Saturday morning, and she saw a sewing class going on when she was 6 or 7, and she said, I want to go. She went directly in there and said, can I learn to do this? And I said, absolutely, and I signed her up for classes, and now she sews things all the time herself.
That's fantastic.
And we gave her a sewing machine for Christmas one year.
Oh, it's brilliant.
So we brought sewing back into the house, which yeah. I had learned. Funny enough, I had learned in Girl Scouts.
Yes. Well, I learned because we had sewing classes at school.
And we had sewing classes at school, but I first learned it in Girl Scouts. I got my sewing badge.
And that's because it was just such, anyway, brilliant formula.
We still have the napkins I sewed for sewing for my Girl Scouts badge.
Lovely. So let's go back to blue jeans. If we're going to buy a pair of jeans, because I'm sure everyone's going to buy one pair a year, where and how should we buy them?
Well, if you buy well jeans, you don't need to buy a new pair every year. Mm. Again, I go back to my daughter and me. In the 80s, we bought really good jeans. Before they were pre-washed, before they were acid washed, we bought really good, solid jeans. It took you 6 months to really break them in until they were soft enough to sit down without being uncomfortable, right?
Remember? Yeah, they had no elastic in them.
No elastic in them. And they were stiff. Mm. And you bought them one size too big. You bought, you know, I bought like 28, 36s. in inches, even though I really needed the 34 inch because in length, because they would shrink. And
yes.
And you would have them shrink to fit.
Yeah, you were meant to line the bath, everyone said.
Exactly. Yeah. And those jeans, they lasted. Yeah. They lasted so long that they've been folded up in the back of my closet. And I had them, I tailored them on my mother's sewing machine, so they really fit well.
Excellent.
That now my daughter's found them and she's wearing them and she looks really cool. And they're in great shape. And they were, and they're faded and as soft as the ones you buy in stores today, but they're 30 years old and they'll last longer because they're of a superior denim than what you find today. Again, if you're buying cheap jeans, those jeans will fall apart and they'll fall apart quickly.
The knees split.
The derriere splits. And, you know, there is a point where you can cut them off at and make cutoffs, but how many people even do that? I do it, but that's because I'm a kid from the 70s, and that's where we got cutoffs. We cut off our jeans. I think that instead of buying, you know, a cheap pair of fashion jeans that will crack and you'll have to throw them away, and they have elastic in them, so they're poisonous to the landfills and to the earth and to the water, it's better to invest and buy a really good pair of selvedge denim jeans that are made of organic cotton and dyed with natural indigo where the water, you know, when you wash them, the water doesn't poison the water table. And there are companies like, there's one I spotlight in the book called Huit, H-U-I-T in Wales. And while their jeans are expensive, it's better to buy one of their pairs of jeans and like mine last 30 years and they always look great. They look so great than to buy, you know, 10 pairs for £30 a piece that wind up going in the bin.
How much are these pairs? Do you remember, darling?
I don't remember, but there may they're a couple hundred probably. And they should be because they cost money to grow organic cotton. It costs money to grow organic indigo. And it costs money to weave it properly and to pay the people who are working all along the supply chain a living or proper wage. So you're investing not only in the jeans, you're investing in community, you're investing in humanity, you're investing in your fellow humans and their lives. You're investing in, if you pay the workers well, then you have less weight on the healthcare system because they don't have health issues. You have less weight on the social net that, you know, helps them with food stamps that they can't, because they can't afford to buy food because they're paid so poorly, that they're not having all these social issues because they're well treated and well paid. So while you're buying more expensive jeans, you're actually saving money in all different ways across the board. It's, we have to think holistically when we buy fashion and wear fashion, and not just think how much am I saving on this product, but think about its impact and think about the impact you're having on society when you buy them.
Fantastic. So tell us about the workers. So what countries are they in? You know, where is this all happening?
Well, I visited Bangladesh and Vietnam, and Bangladesh is the second largest producer of garments in the world after China, but it's a much, much smaller country.
Yes.
So you can get an idea of how many people work in the industry. It's a large portion of their country and their population. And the when I went, how long ago is that now? 2 years or 3 years? 2 years ago, they earned the monthly wage was half of a living wage. So that meant that both parents would have to work in order just to make ends meet. And not just work, but work 6 days a week and have forced overtime that wouldn't be paid. There's no holiday breaks. There's no maternity leave. There's no sick leave. If you didn't go to work, you didn't get paid. And a lot of people, well, I went at the anniversary of Rana Plaza, which was the collapse in 2013 that killed more than 1,000 people.
Yes.
The factory collapse.
Yes.
Where they were making cheap jeans for pretty well-known brands. And a lot of those people, you know, the day before the collapse, the factory had cracked, but they went back to work anyway because they were afraid if they didn't show up for work, they would not be paid their month's wages at the end of the month. You could not miss a day of work or you would be docked. Or you would be fired. And then they died. And the clothes that they were making that day before in the broken factory went out in the market and people bought them and wore them. So, you know, it's hard to imagine how grim some of these places are. Some are not, some are well run, but still people are not paid what they should be paid. And that's because the brands squeeze the workers and negotiate, you know, to the penny. Ethiopia is the new country for manufacturing, and I believe they're paid $24 a month.
Unbelievable.
Without overtime, which is forced upon them.
So that's about £18 or something.
Yeah. Now, you can say, oh, the cost of living in Ethiopia is less, but still, that's really too little. And that means that when you buy the 10-pound shirt, the person who made it was probably paid 10 cents. If that. That's in a good factory. But there are a lot that where it's even less. I visited sweatshops in Los Angeles where undocumented workers were working for $2 an hour, even though the state's minimum wage was $10 or $11 an hour. And, you know, that's in downtown Los Angeles. Where's the oversight? Where are the raids? And the buildings.
Are they immigrants working?
Yeah. And undocumented immigrants. Mm. And the buildings are crumbling, and the fire escape was, you know, barely sticking to the wall. And I didn't want to go out, and I thought the whole thing would collapse. So, you know, these are problems not just in far-flung nations. These are problems I hear about the same happening in Leicester. That there are sweatshops in Leicester where workers earn £2 an hour instead of whatever the minimum wage is now. And, you know, the brands just squeeze. And that's what's creating these artificially low prices. And we've been conditioned to think that these are normal prices when they're not.
So let's talk about the second most wealthy person in the world is the person who owns Zara.
Right. And at the moment that I was visiting Rana Plaza, where the people were earning $68 a month, Mr. Ortega, who owns or was the head of Inditex and is the largest shareholder, and that Inditex includes Zara, was worth $68 billion. $68 a month for $68 billion. Now, if you can get that wealthy off the fingers of the people making clothes, there's something wrong with the system. And we're a part of the system. So we need to question how the system is run and not be resistant to the idea of investing and cherishing clothes and paying what they should be worth. Because if we do, then everybody benefits. Everybody benefits, except that very few, like those in Metropolis, Fritz Lang's movie, living in the shiny towers above ground.
Exactly. So let's talk about the future of shopping. So you say we should be conscious and go to companies who are ethical and we know where their clothes are from. They might be a bit more expensive. What are other ideas out there?
Well, of course, there's resale. You can buy and you can resell.
So that's vintage secondhand.
Vintage secondhand, yeah. But it doesn't even have to be that vintage. It could be just from last season. Say you wore that cocktail dress 3 times and you're kind of over it. Maybe it was something that you bought, you thought you loved and you didn't love. You can put it on a resale website and sell it so somebody else will love it. A friend of mine calls them, not vintage or resale, my friend who's in the business, he calls them pre-loved clothes, which I think is really nice. Mm. And you can, you know, lend to my daughter swaps with her girlfriends. She walked in the kitchen the other day. I'm like, I don't know that sweater. She said, oh, it was Maya's. I'm like, oh, right, it was Maya's. But Maya got tired of it, so now it's mine. I'm like, cool, great. You can, and these are old ideas, you know, sisters borrowing each other's clothes. And then you can repair. So say you tore something. I tore a sweater that I'm wearing. This sweater is 20 years old, and I tore it the other day, and I just got out some black thread, and I patched it up. And could you see? No, you couldn't see that it was torn. You can repair, and you can repair in fun, interesting ways, like taking those classes on embroidery that I was talking about. And then when you have a funny tear on your blue jeans, instead of just tossing the pair of jeans, you can get out some beautiful yarns and threads and embroider something pretty over it.
It's a really good idea.
You can cut them off and turn them into shorts. We used to turn them into A-line skirts.
I remember that. You put a triangle in the middle.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think I still have one or two of those skirts from the 70s or 80s. Yeah. They were fun.
Yeah.
And
what about renting?
And then you can rent. Mm. And rent is really great, especially for special events. I did it recently when I went to the Cannes Film Festival last year.
Lucky you.
And I was there on assignment, and it was a black tie event. And so I thought, right, what am I going to wear? Mm. I'll rent something for $100 as opposed to buying something for $3,000 and wear it for the evening. Or maybe it was 10%. So I spent $300 instead of $3,000. Yep. It was, I felt like Cinderella.
And Tell us what you wore.
It was a Diane von Furstenberg gown. And it had a knit top with long sleeves and a V-neck. And it was one of the wraparound dresses, but it was long with a full pleated skirt and a really beautiful, shiny black material that just swirled when I mm. when I swirled and big look. It was fantastic and moved, and everyone said I looked great. It's a dress I probably would not have bought because it was just a bit. It was well, out
you
there.
Have got the wear. You wouldn't have got the wear.
I would have gotten the wear out yeah. of it, and mm. because you're renting, you sort of mm. dare to do something a little. You get something a bit more audacious yeah. than you would put in your closet, because if you're spending that much money, you're like, well, you know, I want something that I can keep wearing over and over again. That's kind of a notch down. But if you're only going to wear it once, you're like, ah, let's just go for it. And it was really fun. And the next morning, I boxed it up and off it went back to the rental company.
Who are these rental companies?
This was one in Paris called Panoply, mm-hmm. because that was the one in Paris. But there are mm-hmm. all sorts of them. And they're a great resource for, especially, like I said, for weddings, for graduation, yes. for prom, mm-hmm. for, mm-hmm. you know, some sort of, you're invited to a movie premiere and you've never been to one before and you yeah. want to look great.
Well, in England, we've got all like... Ascot and
all those things. Yeah. You know, I buy hats. Hats yeah. are fun, and you can rewear your hats on different events and different, and they don't have to cost an arm and a leg, but you can match them up with different outfits. But it's fun to rent. It's a mm. lot of fun. And
did you have to give a big deposit?
Or? No. I subscribed and I've rented things a lot. I rented for conferences when I had to speak at conferences and I wanted to have a really nice suit, and then it was a talking point for me because I said, hey, and I rented this suit. I've rented a fair amount. It's a lot of fun.
Do you have to clean it afterwards?
No, it's all taken care of.
Wow.
You just send it back. And in Paris, it's delivered by a bicycle messenger, so it's even the delivery is green.
It's fantastic. So do you think kind of mid-market fashion will go that way?
Well, it has, and it does. When I was writing about Mary Catransu, she had some lovely day dresses on there that sort of sell for £600 or £700. And, you know, you go like, that's a lot of money for a dress. But you could rent it for 60, 50 or 60, and you could rent it for 10 days.
Gosh, so you could get a lot of wear out of
it. You could get a lot of wear out of it, and mm-hmm. it's kind of fun. And then it cycles mm-hmm. back, you know, then everyone's like, oh, that was a really great dress. And if you wanted it again, you could rent it again in another time. So it's fun to rent. And I think it's a great way to change up your wardrobe without accumulating too much or throwing things away.
And it's fantastic. I mean, the thing about celebrities is apparently they were asked to rewear
yes.
their clothes at, I think it was the BAFTAs or
yes.
And then the thing is, because they're lent everything, they couldn't...
Well, that's the thing.
You know. So and we're going to do the same thing. Renting is lending. It's the same thing.
Exactly. And a lot of brands have now doing what they call... is it white label? Mm. Basically, the rental company will come in and rent on behalf of the brands or the retailers. So in America, for example, I think they have it here, Urban Outfitters is now renting.
Can't believe it.
And Macy's is going to start renting, and Nordstrom is going to start renting.
Wow.
And brands are looking into it, like, say you want an Yves Saint Laurent tuxedo, but you only need it for this particular event. You can just rent it as opposed to buying it. And so this is the future of retail, to be sure. And it may not be, you know, a big portion of the pie, but it's a definite portion of their pie. And it's great because it gives the garments a longer life.
Exactly.
It keeps them circulating more and not getting just thrown out, perfectly good clothes thrown away or sent to charity.
So you said that you found some designers which you found very exciting because they were ethical and conscious. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Well, of course, the leader in this movement is Stella McCartney. And she's been doing this since day one. And the reason she's been doing it since day one is, well, if you think about it, she is the daughter of two of the most famous hippies out there. And so she was raised in a household that was vegetarian, fur-free, and leather-free. And it's in her DNA. This is how she's always lived. So when she went to start her own business, that's where she started.
And that was a long time ago. I mean,
she's celebrating her 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
And even before, when she had her own little brand, Tiny, out of school, she would go to Portobello Road and buy beautiful old silk nightgowns and lingerie, or find beautiful old buttons. And so she was sourcing vintage to create new things. She was doing that upcycling already when this was not done back in the, you know, 97, 98, even 96. So, and it was always really pretty. And so she's a leader in this. And she's not only a leader in the way she runs her brand, which, by the way, when she started, everyone said she was out of her mind. And in fact, she was just ahead of the curve. She was
happened to a lot of women in history. Yes,
and they said she was crazy. And now everyone's going, she might have had a point there. And but she also godmothers a lot of interesting startups in the supply chain, like, or she either godmothers them or sources from them or supports them somehow, helps get their message out, underwrites them, invests in them. Like, there's a company called Bolt Threads out in Silicon Valley, and they're creating silk in a lab. So you don't have to kill the silkworms in order to get the silk from the cocoon. They're actually creating it through DNA and growing the silk in a laboratory in a vat of yeast. And she loved that because she said, you know, I've always had trouble with silk. You know, it's bothered me because of killing the silkworm in order to get the silk. And she tried cruelty-free silk, but she said the quality just wasn't quite there for a luxury company. And, you know, the thread would break or, you know, wasn't quite as strong. And this is an alternative. So she created the first garment out of this synthetic, it's not a synthetic silk, it's lab-grown silk. Lab-grown silk for an exhibition at the Modern Museum of Art in New York about 2 years ago. And then an outfit, a brown, chocolate brown pants suit for an exhibition fashioned by Nature, I think it was called, at the V&A last year. And it's just beautiful, luminous fabric, as silk is. And so this company is going forward. They're also making a leather out of the root systems of mushrooms. And she's working with them to create handbags. And for her, this is a wonderful solution because until now, fake leather was pretty rough on the environment too. It was plastified. It was made of
are you saying this book that PVC is one PVC, of the worst things you can ever buy?
And or it was made of, you know, petroleum-based. And so she was, you know, or it didn't hold up very well. But this is real leather, but it's made out of animal, it's made out of vegetable base as opposed to
cellulose
animal.
Or whatever.
And and they're made out of this root systems of mushrooms. And so for her, this is a wonderful solution. And she's helping take that forward and scale it up to a commercial level so that everybody, all the businesses can source from it, not just Stella. Then she's also working with a company out of Seattle called Evernew. And Evernew is a company started by a woman named Stacy Flynn that takes your old t-shirts and socks and underwear, cotton, old cotton, and breaks it down to its molecular level and regenerates it into a virgin quality of cellulose to be spun into cotton again. And so you can keep recycling what we're throwing away and keep reusing it. Now, this is great on a bunch of different levels. First, it's circular, which means that we're not throwing things into the waste bin, that we're keeping it in the cycle. Before we had birth of a product, use of a product, death of a product. Now we're going to have birth of a product, use of a product, rebirth of a product, use of a product, rebirth of the product.
Fantastic.
Use of the product. And this is what the Ellen MacArthur Foundation is pushing.
Yes.
It's about circularity.
Now she's an English yacht. I think of her as a round-the-world yachtswoman.
Yes, but she's started a foundation in the Isle of Wight. And its mission is to make circularity the only way we consume and produce clothes.
What a fantastic woman.
And so Stacy's company, Evernew, does this with cotton. Now, another thing that people would say, you would immediately say is, but what about all the cotton farmers? Aren't they going to lose their business? Well, no. Because today, 99% of our cotton is what I call manhandled, meaning that it's genetically modified and it's also chemically modified, you know, doused with chemicals and pesticides, but it's been bred in a way to and treated with chemicals in a way that it produces 6 times more cotton per plant than it would if it was organic.
Wow.
So there's a story we used to tell about, you know, that puts this in perspective about cows that were fed hormones in America, the dairy cows, to produce 4 times more milk. Well, this created a mess because the cows would be milked 4 times more often. So then their udders got infected. Then they had to be given antibiotics. So now we're drinking the antibiotics and the hormones. And And then they had a shorter lifespan because their body was having to produce so much, and then they died. And it was just everything was overstimulated and overused and overworked to a point that it was damaging on every front and not good for us. The only people who helped were the people making milk because they made four times as much money. But it was bad on every other front. Well, cotton's the same way. The farmers are growing this cotton that when they treat it with a certain chemical produces six times much more cotton. But that means that the plant requires six times more water. And this is how cotton became known as a thirsty plant. Cotton, organic cotton, actually likes to be stressed. It doesn't like water. It likes really poor soil. That's what forces it into flower, which is the cotton bowl. And farmers would think of cotton as one of their, what they call the last resort crops. When your soil is really depleted and tired and you don't have the money to plow in good, you know, compost and everything to build it back up, you could plant cotton and get another season out of it because it liked poor soil and you didn't need, and if you had a drought, that's why it was grown in places where it's hot and dry, because it didn't need water. It was grown in Egypt. It was grown in the south of the United States. It was grown it's grown in Arizona. Mm-hmm. It's grown out in the dry areas of Southern California and in Texas, where, you know, there's no water. So the problems of cotton are man-made. The environmental cotton problems are man-made. And if we were to go back to, if we were to recycle and regenerate the cotton that we already have out there so it doesn't wind up in landfill, we could then stop producing six times more cotton than we need in the fields and go back to organic cotton. Again, I say, now you would say, okay, who's going to fight this? Well, industrial farming will fight this because cotton is paid by yield. So if you get six times more cotton out of your plant, you get six times more money. Organic cotton does cost more for the moment because it only accounts for 1% of all of the cotton yield. It's a bit like that cell phone thing I was talking about earlier. When there weren't any cell phones, they were expensive. When there were a lot of cell phones, the market dropped. When there wasn't a lot of organic food out there, organic food was expensive. Now that it's everywhere, it's affordable. The same would go with organic cotton. If we could get 10%, 20%, 30% of the crops being cotton crops being organic, the price of organic cotton would go down. And farmers might not make as much money, but they wouldn't have to invest less in their fields. They wouldn't have to pay for the herbicides. They wouldn't have to pay for the pesticides. They wouldn't have to pay for the chemicals to produce the six times more cotton. They wouldn't have to pay for all that irrigation and water.
The most going to be the next crisis on Earth.
It is. So in the end, if you crunch the numbers, it makes sense. And you would probably come out ahead. This, I write about the same in relation to indigo. Indigo, natural indigo makes up 1% of our dye. Synthetic indigo is 99%. Synthetic indigo has only existed for about 120 years. It was created by the BASF Chemical Corporation in Germany. And it includes really harmful chemicals to humans and the planet, such as formaldehyde and cyanide. I often joke that, you know, in those spy movies, when you have like the cyanide pill in your magic ring, and if you get caught by the bad guys, you can take your cyanide pill. Well, you could also eat your jeans. So, you know, indigo, while the farmers were paid more to farm, they're growing indigo now in tobacco fields in Tennessee. And indigo is one of the few crops that actually nourishes the soil. It's like soy. It puts nitrogen back in the soil. Mm. It also requires zero pesticides or pesticides because bugs don't like it. It's bitter. So it's a natural pesticide. And if you have indigo around your other plants, you don't need to put pesticides on them because the bugs just don't come around because there's that nasty thing over there that they don't like. And so the tobacco farmers, while they are paid less to farm the natural indigo in their former tobacco fields, tobacco having moved offshore, they actually make more money because they're investing less in the farming of the indigo. Plus, it's a much more pleasant thing to farm. Tobacco is a nasty crop. I think the only thing that's nastier is sugarcane. And farmers complain about, you know, the horrible conditions they have to work in and what they have to do in order to grow and harvest tobacco. But indigo is easy. You plant it, it grows, you pick it, you dry it, it turns into dye. And they're not having to go out there and spray. They're not having to, you know, keep, it just does its thing. It's easy. So they're actually making more money. Even though they're paid less, they're making more money.
It's fantastic. So what would indigo, because quite often when you buy some blue and they say, oh, careful, you know, near, you know, don't get your white shirt near it or anything, you know.
Well, you have to wash it a few times.
Yeah. How does it stabilize?
It does stabilize. Mm. A friend of mine bought some indigo. Also, natural indigo is so much more beautiful than synthetic indigo. And when you see it on someone, you go like, wow, it's like sapphire. You know, when we try to recreate the colors of nature, they're never quite as beautiful. We love Monet's paintings of the sunsets and the sunrises. But
in real life, it's better.
But it's
real life is always
even
better.
A photograph doesn't capture what you really saw. Well, the same thing with natural indigo versus synthetic indigo. I mean, I saw the woman who's growing the natural indigo in Tennessee. I went to see Sarah Bellows. She came in these jeans that just looked like she was wearing the cloth equivalent of sapphires. They were luminous. They just radiated. And they were this rich blue that was so pretty. A cornflower blue. And so we bought some when we were in Japan because we visited the old school denim people in Japan.
And my girlfriend, fabric or jeans?
Jeans. Yeah. We bought jeans and my girlfriend put them on having not washed them, and she wore them on a hot day.
Oh, no.
and her legs turned blue. So you do have to wash them. And then she went and looked at the label and said, wash these jeans three times before you wear them. And it's like, oh, right. Okay. But then you do, and you're not supposed to wash your jeans. I don't remember how many times you were supposed to wash it. It's indicated. She just hadn't read the directions. But, you know, you're not supposed to wash jeans very often, if ever. So they were originally the most sustainable product.
Okay.
They were made for miners crawling around in the earth. Mm. They were made to last. Those rivets weren't decorative. They were to hold seams together. And miners would pass them down from, you know, once they'd struck gold or silver or whatever they were after, then they would pass it to the next guy who was out there looking for it, and they'd be patched up and they'd just be worn. Chip Berg, the CEO of Levi, says you should never wash your jeans. Now, there comes a point in our lives where, like, our jeans could walk out the room themselves.
Yeah,
then you can wash them, but you shouldn't wash them after wearing them just once.
No. I had to train my son to do that. He thought
they were like any other garment.
Yeah, exactly. It's you wait. Well, two or 3 weeks at least. You know, I have, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like I'm a smelly person, but no. I just think trousers. Also, don't wash anything unless you have to.
Absolutely.
I mean, don't you think? You
know, and then.
And dry clean, you shouldn't.
No, and wash them. Mm. I was told, you know, we should wash to have just one way for the individual to have a positive impact on the environment in our climate crisis, is to wash your clothes less. And then when you do wash them on the cold cycle short, the short cycle.
Okay.
And if you stop to think about it, you go, right, okay, the short cycle means less water, and they'll still get just as clean. The cold water means that you're not heating up the water, so you're using less energy. But also with things that are made of polyester, like fleece, when you heat it up, it releases microfibers. And when you wash it longer and spin it longer, it releases more microfibers. Mm-hmm. If you wash short and you wash cold, you're releasing less microfibers into the water.
But does cold get the germs out?
Yeah, and it gets them clean enough.
It does?
Yeah, and it gets them clean enough.
And what washing
Or warm, or yeah. say warm, but yeah. you know, you don't need or to boil
like
your clothes. Yeah. You don't need to boil your clothes. And the person who said this, and the numbers, I don't remember the numbers because they were pretty big numbers, but if each person did that, just switched from, say, hot to warm, and from warm to cold when you're doing darker things, and you use the short cycle instead of the long cycle, then the amount of water and energy used per person, per wash, was extraordinary and adds up really, really quickly. And the person who told me this was the man at Procter & Gamble, you know, who's in charge of laundry detergent.
Yes.
He wants you to wash your clothes, and he says, we're washing our clothes too much.
Well, that's not, I trust him.
Me too. So I thought if he's saying it, We got to listen.
Fantastic, fantastic. So what is the future? Do you think we... I mean, you know all these fantastic facts. You're just brilliant on the, you know, but what really is going to happen out there?
Well, what's really going to happen, I don't know. If I had a crystal ball, then I would invest in what's going to happen, and then I wouldn't have to work anymore. So I don't know, but I do know that the companies, I mean, I was just talking to somebody about this morning at a major brand, and the companies who don't change their ways, the fashion companies who don't radically change the way they do business and radically change their supply chains are not going to last. Because consumers are demanding transparency and consumers are demanding responsibility. And we need this to meet all the climate goals set by the UN. We need radical change. You can't tweak an existing model. It's not going to work because the model at its core is wrongheaded, plain up wrongheaded. And it has been for 250 years since Arkwright started Cottonopolis in Manchester. You know, working the poor to death in order to make a few rich, which my husband says, you know, you're getting a little bit Marxist there, my dear. I'm like, well, yeah, but there is something to that. Maybe we need a dash of Marxism after 30 years of unbridled and unchecked capitalism. Just a dash, like Tabasco, you know? And then the impact that this idea of volume, the business model based on volume has on the planet is just too much. So you have to cut volume in your production. Think about things like, and adopt practices like direct to consumer and made to order and, you know, zero waste. Because if you don't, you're not going to make it. It's bad business to be wasteful. And consumers will not go to you if they know you're wasteful. They will not step in your store. It's going to come to that. And it's coming very quickly. It's coming very quickly. It's like a tidal wave. And suddenly in 5 years, we saw Forever 21 go bankrupt this last fall. We saw Barney's go bankrupt this fall. You're going to see a lot more bankruptcies. And you're going to see big names that where you've been shopping for a long time go under. And they're going to go under really fast. H&M had been having trouble, and they've just now posted numbers saying they just had their best year in years, in 5 years, I think it was. But they have been working on becoming more sustainable, aggressively so. They haven't changed their volume model yet, and they're going to have to, but they're working on it. They're doing things like pulling in circularity.
It's Nordic, you know, it should be a really good example.
It's not. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to look at those numbers, but those numbers also might be, you know, the numbers don't really tell you what's happening. They can not fiddle with numbers, but, you know, profits could be going up simply because they've cut costs in their supply chain.
Exactly.
And how have they cut costs? Well, maybe they cut costs by having zero waste. Maybe they cut costs because they just you're paying people less. So you have to dig deep on that. But they are doing things like working with more sustainable cotton, getting away from conventional cotton. They're using more organic cotton, not a lot, but a bit. They're working with Stacy. I don't know if they're working with Stacy Flynn. They're working with a company called Worn Again that takes cotton poly blends, separates them, and regenerates them the same way that Evernew does with cotton.
I went in there the other day to look at their kind of their homeware. I think I saw a thing saying if you bring in a bag of clothes,
we'll give you a credit.
Yeah.
They're trying to get people to not throw clothes away. But they're still, as long as they have the volume as their model, they're going to have troubles. So I think you're going to see a shift very quickly, and the brands that make the radical systemic change are going to do well, and the ones who keep trying to tweak their existing model that is a damaging one will not, and they'll sink really fast.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and explaining how we should shop.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. So Fashionopolis is available in Britain by Head of Zeus. What about in America? Because we also sell...
Penguin.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming over from Paris to us today during Fashion Week.
My pleasure. Anytime.